And we want you to share your thoughts with us. A little bit later on in the broadcast, we're going to be talking about what transpired in Houston, the devastation to that city and to that region of the United States, and how the federal government is responding to it, and how the people are responding to it, and how you, the American people, are responding to that with some generous donations from all over the country. But I do want to begin, again, this is probably about the fourth or fifth time in the last couple of months that our lead story really is North Korea. They seem to know exactly when to do their tests because it dominates the Sunday morning shows and the Sunday evening programs. And again, yesterday it was bigger and bolder than ever before. It was a hydrogen bomb that North Korea has tested. Lieutenant Colonel Ryan Yantis joins us. 22 years in the U.S. Army, and Colonel, you were on this program a couple of weeks ago, and you shared with all of the other guests sort of the dire feeling that you had about North Korea and its implications. Let's put that in context to what's happened in the last 24, 48 hours.
Well, Bruce, thanks for having me on, and delighted to join you tonight. The news out of North Korea and their announcement that they were successful in detonating a hydrogen bomb device underground in a test chamber is a game changer. A lower yield kiloton range nuclear weapon would do a lot of damage to a city. A hydrogen bomb could basically take out a large American city or a large city in Japan. If they have those devices and they are suitable for mounting on an ICBM, or as we discussed the last time I was on, bringing it into a port on a freighter, that's a capability that warrants even greater attention.
Roberto Montagna also joins us. You're a Democrat. You're also a veteran. And when you've been on this program, I would describe you as a conservative Democrat. I think you've been on this program when we've talked about North Korea. They seem to be unaffected by anything that we do, either what we've been doing for the last 15 years or what Donald Trump has been doing for the last, let's say, 6 months. Ryan just said it's a game changer. Is it a game changer? And if so, how has the game changed?
I think, first of all, just thank you for having us on. And, of course, thoughts and prayers with Houston, and I'm sure we'll get to that. But towards North Korea, right now we're doing these annual exercises, the Ulchi Freedom Guardian. We've got a lot of troops there. And there's kind of a pattern that sort of emerges. They're mad that we do these things. They do something ridiculous. We've got 50,000 troops in Japan, 25,000, in South Korea, another 6,000 in Guam. We have total dominance in the airspace, Patriot missile systems.
You say total dominance, but I would say that we're totally trapped. What can we do? We talk. What can we do?
Well, I mean, there is a threat. If I was playing for the North Koreans, I would pull that big card in 5 months during the Olympics. I wouldn't do it today. Because it's about a show. This is a mind game. They're trying to let us know that they're still relevant. The whole purpose of this isn't, I think, suicidal. I don't think that their leader is crazy. I think he's rational, playing a very weak hand. What we can do is we can work with the Chinese. The Chinese control the bulk of the influence here. They control all their fuel, all their food. And if we're going to do some kind of sanctions, we have to get those bankers in China that are playing that game.
Martha Music also joins us, making your first appearance, a Republican. Nice to have you with us, Martha. As you look at this story about how it's unfolded, it seems to me that we're trying everything, but the other side doesn't seem to be wanting to play ball in any way.
Yeah, thank you, Bruce, for having me on. It, from an ordinary citizen point of view, it is a scary situation because we don't want a war in that peninsula. But diplomacy hasn't been helping for years. So what do we do? I mean, you're right, Roberto. We have all the military power. We're the superpower over there. But do we want to be?
Mark Costello also joins us. You are a liberal Democrat. You're not in favor of war, but you also don't want the United States attacked in any way. Sure. What do we do?
Well, long before I was born, my father was in the Army on the demilitarized zone in Korea, as part of the peacekeeping force shortly following the war. Since 2006, the UN Security Council has passed seven resolutions and sanctions, increasingly more stringent sanctions on North Korea. But I think isolating them isn't the answer. Donald Trump, when he was running, talked about engaging in dialogue, direct dialogue with Kim Jong-un. And I think the strongest weapon we have as a nation is the power of our capitalist system to influence the culture, influence the people. And I think the more you can do to bring North Korea back into the community of nations, more to get the economics reestablished with the country, the less they're going to be hopefully seeking that weapon. But the danger we've had in the past is we've been in this sort of quid pro quo. We'll throw some billions of dollars your way if you we promise you won't make nuclear weapon advances, and we've made that mistake in the past.
Colonel?
So last time I was on, one of the points that we discussed was DIME. The four tenets, the four pillars of national power are diplomacy, information, military, and economic. We have been nattering around with the economic and military in North Korea through deterrence presence that we've discussed. We've engaged in diplomacy, but it's been partial diplomacy because we don't recognize them. We don't have ambassadorial contact. The thing that I see as being the linchpin and the greatest weakness of the Kim family regime is information. It is such a closed, hermetically sealed country. There's a great article in Fast Company talks about the efforts to help breach that from Silicon Valley and getting small satellite receivers that are easily transportable into North Korea so they can get information real time and it's accessible to the average North Korean. Once they hear and they get some other news source than the official party line out of Pyongyang, that's going to go a lot towards opening the doors and reducing their control.
Well, one thing the president said is he said he wants to cut off, trade to all nations that are trading with them. Now, that's China, that's Russia, that's India, and others. Those are the big three. It would seem to me that that's something we should have done years ago, or certainly months ago. Well, why are we just starting to think about that now?
I'm not an economist, but I have been noting that North Korea, for example, had a great deal of trade back in the 80s with Grenada. They were very supportive of the Grenada efforts to become a socialist country. And, part of the assertion is that Reagan's actions into Grenada was a foretelling of problems for North Korea. But they've done a lot of on-the-ground work in Africa and other developing nations that's flown under the radar. And that's a stern warning to them.
Let's talk more about that when we come back. 1-800-723-8029 from coast to coast and border to border. I'm Bruce Dumont. Hop on the line, give us a call tonight, and happy Labor Day wherever you're listening from coast to coast.
Best chow hall ever.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us. 1-800-723-8029 is the phone number. I want to get back to how much pressure really we have over China and Russia. And I'm going to ask this panel a question I asked a couple of weeks ago. Why would China or why would Russia be trying to help us now? Mm-hmm. Mark, why would they be doing it? What's in it for them?
At this point, I don't see that we have much leverage. With China, of course, we do with the trading power that we have with China. But Russia's been emboldened, Crimea, Ukraine. So I don't see any clear reason why they would.
Does anybody, Martha, what about you? Do they have a reason to want to help us?
I don't see where either Russia or China has any reason to want to help the United States in this situation. Like Mark said, it's Russia's been emboldened. United States hasn't held them accountable. China's got the trade, but they also have a ownership of a lot of debt with us.
Right. Yeah.
So
there's a real limit to how tough we can get to China because they're holding so much of our paper.
I think China's interested. They don't want the humanitarian crisis coming over the border. They also don't want nuclear volleyball just bouncing around. And thirdly, they could take some territory because if that situation gets kinetic, God forbid, then they're going to rush down as fast as they can, I think, and take some territory, just like in the Korean War. And we're going to, because otherwise what's going to happen is they'll have a unified South Korea because make no mistake, North Korea loses that war. And then South Korea, our ally, is right on their border.
What do you say? North Korea loses the war
against South Korea,
but not if they go nuclear.
Sure. What was it? So they horribly massacre.
Do you agree with that, Colonel? That North Korea loses the war.
Having been on the ground in South Korea near the DMZ for about 18 months, it's very, very tough terrain. And having read the accounts and followed the history of the UN forces, and it was United Nations. It was not just American and South Korean, but it was 27 some odd different countries that contributed. Tough terrain to fight in. And the North Koreans have had generations to dig in and prepare to defend North Korea. Last time I was on, I talked about the don't try to predict what the North Koreans are going to do. You're dealing with a regime that has been willing to use a nerve agent to execute one member of the Kim family. They've been willing to use special forces and terrorist-type tactics to bring down planes and attack fixed facilities in friendly countries. So they're not just going to go with a conventional fight. They're going to go asymmetric, and it's not just going to be constrained to the Korean Peninsula. Put myself in the family Kim's position. I'm going to take away Guam. I'm going to try to take away and inhibit activities from Japan because those were both used as fixed Air Force bases in support of the last Korean War. And the air war against North Korea was so brutal, they have not forgotten that lesson. We have.
Let's go back to this. The Korean conflict ended, but there was no signed treaty. How come? Why was there not a treaty signed to end the Korean War? There was a ceasefire, right?
There's an armistice. Yep.
But no treaty.
We're at war, technically.
Why was there no treaty signed? And is there anything that we could do today that would get them to sign a treaty, a peace treaty?
I don't know, but that goes into that diamond acronym that I mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. That's on the diplomatic side. There was an armistice that was not completely signed and ratified by all participants, but has been adhered to. South Korea, for example, refused to sign because there was questions about the repatriation of POWs, prisoners of war. There is a cessation of hostilities in the Korean Peninsula, but that document was between the United Nations and North Korea and their proxies. There was never a declaration of war by the U.S. Congress, so we've never been at war with North Korea, which is an important point bluntly to make on the information side.
Martha, question to you. If you were North Korea, why would you want to change anything that you're doing right now? You have the attention of the world. You have the United States fearful that they may act and engage in a war. They know the domestic politics. They know the conversations. They all lead back to, well, we can't do anything militarily. And yet this guy continues to grow his program, and no one is telling him in any significant way to stop that he believes in. Why should they change anything? Why don't they just keep doing what they're doing?
Well, I think that's what Kim Jong-un is doing. I mean, he doesn't have a reason to stop because the world is finally recognizing him. You know, it's he's got the world stage paying attention to him, so...
Because we, the United Nations and the West, and the United States and the West, we treat people with nuclear weapons differently.
Right.
Gaddafi.
Right.
Right. But I would say he's got three reasons. Kelly, Mathis, McMaster. And those are the three men that are surrounding our president now, and they're giving him guidance. And they know the capabilities. And, you know, Mathis today, Secretary of Defense Mathis, says, you know, we have the capacity to totally obliterate this opponent. We don't want to do that, but that's an option on the table.
We have the option to do that without South Korea or Japan being obliterated as well?
Oh, no. Everything that I'm saying now is positing a retaliation. I'm not saying that we're going to aggress on them. Yeah, but as a secondary measure, if they attack, it's suicide.
But do you believe that those three, were they cheering the president when he said, we're going to show them fire and fury unlike the world has
never seen? I'm not an executive at that level, but I would say that that wasn't helpful, just respectfully. And I think that since he hasn't done it again, we're not going to do this via tweet. We're going to do this via strategic analysis. We're going to employ RAND Corporation, our best minds at DOD, and we're going to have a long-term view. I mean, and the Army way is a slow and steady. We're going to hold that territory forever.
Mark?
Well, what I'm, you know, most befuddled by is the lack of any sort of coherent strategic, you know, a plan as far as I see. For example, going after South Korea on the trade agreement in the midst of this tense crisis seems, you know, totally backwards. You've got mixed messages coming out where President Trump saying one thing, and then you've got his diplomatic side coming back countering that. So we're not sending a very clear signal, and we need our allies on board. We, you know, President Trump's been doing a good job communicating with Shinzo Abe of Japan. Mm-hmm. You know, so there's some positive work there, but I just there's some dissonance to me. You know, where the president. You know, and it's more than optics. It's a strategic fumble. You know, for example, in the wake of Charlottesville, then to go pardon Joe Arpaio while we're in the midst of sort of racial and civil unrest, and then here where we need South Korea as our ally, and we're you know stepping on their toes and kicking them a bit. You know, it's very troubling.
But go ahead, Martha. I think some of that trade stuff with South Korea is a little snit that the United States is having because the South Korea wants to continue diplomacy, mm-hmm. and diplomacy hasn't been working. So it's kind of like, in my watching it, it's kind of like a tit for tat sort of thing. But on the China, you asked earlier, Bruce, you know, what would China have, you know?
Oh.
And I think Japan is a critical component in here because China does not want to see a strong Japan in that region.
No.
So can we leverage somehow the talk shows were all today about more sanctions, and the sanctions that we need from China are the fuel sanctions, mm-hmm. you know, cutting off their fuel supply and stuff. So how do we make that happen and get China on board there?
Colonel?
Okay. The historian in me is going to circle back
sure.
and say we had in a previous generation this Japanese militarism in the 1930s and 40s, and we were dealing with them with international pressure and the League of Nations and sanctions. And then they stepped forward boldly and seized some French and Dutch holdings. And Roosevelt imposed a rubber, mm-hmm. metal, and gas embargo and said, you're cut off. And it was that point where the Japanese sat down and said, okay, we've been thinking about attacking Pearl Harbor for a while. Get busy on doing it. So sanctions, one, have a mixed review on working.
Mm-hmm.
We've done sanctions to aggressor nations for long periods of time without any real results. So that's the E of the economic. You can mm-hmm. use in one
sure.
leg. You got to use all four legs. And you got to understand that when we do something that is a fundamental threat to the longevity of that regime, because that's a real nexus point. You talked about him being, Roberto mentioned that the Kim family, Kim Jong-un, is a rational actor. He is, as long as you understand he's acting rationally to retain his power and his family's control
right.
over their kingdom. And if anything gets in the way of that, that's when you're going to get the outwardly irrational response, because he's going to do anything he can to protect his rice bowl.
Well, I think I'm with Mark on this. We grow the rice bowl. We give him some kind of economic opportunity that broadens that, grows his power in a way that's non-threatening. Like I hate to say, just throw food at him, but, you know, why is China the only player in there? Because they're the only ones giving him food and energy. If he had another option, he might be a little bit more.
But maybe he doesn't care. If he doesn't care about his starving people, maybe how is giving them more food going to help?
Well, the food would come in my view. Rex Tillerson would do like Voice of America, something like that. We can do a covert infiltration of radios and projecting signals into that territory. We can win hearts and minds. We know we won with Cold War with blue jeans and blues, not bullets and bombs.
1-800-723-8229. Good line to go to a commercial break on. We got lots of callers on the line. 1-800-723-8029. From coast to coast and border to border, this is Labor Day weekend 2017. You're listening to Beyond the Beltway live from Chicago. I'm Bruce Dumont.
want the
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. 1-800-723-8029. Lots of callers. I'm in line. Let's go to Brian listening in Roselle, Illinois. He's listening on the internet tonight. Brian, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Enjoy the discussion.
Thank you.
You know, this whole development, it really points out our failure in dealing with Red China. We've made colossal mistakes dealing with China. Ever since Nixon opened China, we've made mistake after mistake. Bill Clinton giving China WTO was a colossal mistake. We should have always had conditional trade agreements with China. It was idiotic to let them in the WTO. China holds all the cards in this situation. China could defuse this crisis in a few days if they wanted to. But they're not doing it because they have all the leverage because of our idiotic politicians who are greedy corporatists who are always just looking for money, you know, and Walmart and all these global corporations that just lusted after the Chinese market and Chinese manufacturing. They couldn't get enough of it fast enough.
Brian, let me interrupt for just a second because I think you've stated a lot of things that a lot of people even on this program and listening would agree with. But we are where we are right now with mistakes made by presidential administrations going back three or four administrations and differences that you may have with Donald Trump for the last 7 months. What do we do now? In your view now, if you had the ear of the president and his big three military and international diplomatic State Department folks, what would you be telling him to do? What's Brian's plan from Roselle, Illinois?
I would start jawboning the Chinese. Every misstep they take, you know, the Spratly Islands in the South China Sea, every little screwy thing they do, I would call them on the carpet about it in a presidential news conference every step of the way. Every time they steal our intellectual property, everything they've done should be brought out in the public and emphasized. I mean, unfortunately, half the American public are idiots and don't even know that we fought the Chinese in North Korea in the 1950s. They don't even know that. They don't know what the Chinese are doing to us because they're idiots, because our politicians are corporatists who will not expose all the Chinese thievery and shenanigans.
Roberto, let's go to Roberto. Let's get his – we'll get everybody's response. Brian wants to take a very hard line, embarrassing line against China, telling the truth, telling it like it is, in the hopes that they somehow will then be cooperative. Roberto, what
first,
do you think of
first,
that idea?
First, thanks for the call. I'd like to say that those idiots vote, and we have to communicate to those quote-unquote idiots. I don't think they're idiots. I think people just – they're busy, and they don't take an interest in politics, and, you know, we get the leaders that we deserve. And so if we don't like those leaders, we have to vote better leaders in. But that being said,
should China be reminded of all the things Brian just stated publicly?
Yeah, but that's not China's not going to be concerned about being shamed. I mean, they're not in the popularity game. They're looking at a 5,000-year, you know, continual game, and we've been around.
Brian, why do you think they would respond differently if they did the hard line that you suggested? Why would they change their way if you publicly embarrassed and humiliated them? Let's say everything you said is true, but again, why would they respond positively?
Well, they might not, but see, we got to draw the connection to corporate, the globalist corporate America, like Walmart and all these manufacturers just had to get into China. Make them put the pressure on China. How about Apple Computer? You know, they've changed the world. They're the world's richest corporation, but they cannot survive without communist China to build their iPhones that every American must have. You know, we got to put the pressure on the corporations that deal with the shady Chinese. Maybe that will help.
All right. See, let's let Mark is usually speaking against the corporatist all the time when he's on this show. So Brian may be singing a song that you like.
Well, and I understand exactly where Brian's coming from. But I think these voters that he described as fools, you know, they believed Trump when he said, I'm going to come out and label China a currency manipulator. That was, you know, his whole campaign was, I'm going to talk tough to China. And then he came in, he's like, scratch that. I think I'm going to dial that back. But the American consumer is also to blame, too, because we're shopping at these horrible corporations, and we're addicted to these cheap pieces of
Following up on Brian's suggestion, if the leaders of Apple and Walmart and companies that he did not mention, if they went and talked to the Chinese, would the Chinese react in any different way?
You know, I did work at Walmart.
I know.
And at their home office, they carried a tremendous amount of leverage against all of their vendors. So if Walmart said tomorrow that they wanted paper, the packaging changed from paper to plastic, it was done within a week. So certainly Walmart could carry some weight and influence in China. But we're talking about a massive economy here that's so far beyond, you know, the population that we have, that it's so how can you influence that with our consumer choices even, or tough talk?
I want to get everybody's response to your suggestion. Colonel?
Well, and I don't know, Brian, if I'm going to answer your question, but a couple of generations ago, one of the things that we had in common with the Soviet Union was that they played chess and we played chess. That was a commonality of a games and a logic form. The Chinese have a tradition, while they're good at chess, their basis is a game called Go, which is even more intricate, and it's a very strategic game with a lot of tactical overtones. The Chinese have the legacy of several thousand years of culture, and being shamed by a country that's an upstart with 250. And, oh, by the way, we're not even good Chinese. We're mongrels and we're mixed and we're everybody's refugees. Mm-hmm. The one thing that we do have, and this is the leverage kind of the corporatist and of Walmart, is that they have a very restive internal audience that has had a taste of what the outside world can provide. They've found about blue jeans. They've found about Western entertainment, smartphones, and all that. And if something were to disrupt that economy in China, the old analogy, and again, I'm not an economist, but, you know, if America catches cold, China gets the flu or pneumonia, mm-hmm. because the ripples of the underpinnings of their economic strength are not as deep as ours.
Martha, so where do you come down on Brian's suggestion?
Well, I agree with what Brian's saying, that I think large corporations like Walmart, Apple, have the capability of having influence. But to Mark's point, it's the consumer here that's not going to allow that to happen, because the minute our prices go up because we put influence out there, we're not going to like it. We like our toys. We like them cheap, and we want them readily available.
And we don't care if they're made in China.
And we don't care.
Brian, we're going to move on. Thanks very much for your call. Kevin, listening to us on WCGO, our flagship station in Chicago. Go ahead.
Yeah, just a couple of observations, and then I'll hang up and let your panel weigh in. I believe that North Korea is acting from a defensive, almost rational position, and I base that on a couple of things. 15 years ago, Bush put North Korea, Iran, and Iraq on the axis of evil. Mm-hmm. We invaded Iraq on pretty bad evidence. And I think the message was sent internationally, you either go big or you go away. Unsurprisingly, Iran and North Korea have aggressively pursued nuclear weapons. But I think it's from a defensive position. And you guys spoke earlier about how the U.S. treats countries differently with nuclear weapons. Also, I think if you are looking to be aggressive and attack countries, you don't put photo ops and press releases out of every incremental development of your nuclear program, which is what North Korea is doing. I think that's for an external audience to see, you know, what they're capable of and where they're going. It also is important because I think they do feel existentially threatened, and I don't think any government, any regime, particularly a dictator that feels that way, will ever give up nuclear weapons in the face of even strong sanctions. I think Trump's language is problematic. I think if a country feels threatened, you don't come at them and talk about fire and brimstone. And one of your panelists talked about it, but I think it's important that we should really think about more engagement and not less. Things like peace treaties, the sort of sunshine policy that South and North Korea had maybe a decade ago that's fallen away. And I think to make North Korea feel less threatened, I don't think the nukes are ever going away. The only country to ever really give them up was South Africa, and they did that because there was no really geopolitical reason to have them on the African continent.
So Kevin, hang on, just stay on the line. Let's go around the table. Colonel, you want to respond to some of the things that Kevin had to say?
Well, There's a lot that I heard and I agree with, and I'm going to go back to the earlier point I made about information. The more information we get into the North Korean people, past the minders, past the government censors, the better it is for them in the long run, because this overall situation in North Korea is going to be best solved by the North Koreans themselves. I do think your observation, Kevin, about the proudly pronouncing and showing the world all of their development step by step is a bit of bravado, but it's also, this is what we have and we're ready to use.
We can't say that American intelligence dropped the ball on this, because they're not doing anything secret. They're doing it out front with photo ops.
They're doing it with mass market media, and they're making sure everybody knows. And an earlier point I made last time I was here is the profound lack of human intelligence that we have on the ground in North Korea. We don't know in good empirical fashion what is really on the ground there and what's happening.
Kevin, we're going to move on. Thanks very much for your call. We appreciate it. When we come back, you alluded a little while ago when we were off the air, Colonel, to the 40-40 Club. I want you to explain the 40-40 Club. Folks, you don't want to miss this. It's the 40-40 Club, and it will be explained when we come back. It relates to North Korea and how things might change in North Korea. But first of all, you better change the 40-40 Club. I've teased it as well as I can. Back shortly with answers when we roll on from Chicago. I'm Bruce Dumont. Before we go back to calls, I want to talk a little bit about Muammar Gaddafi, or you want to talk about Muammar Gaddafi and what happened to him.
Yeah, over the break we were discussing why Kim Jong-un would be so adamant about obtaining nuclear weapons, and I gave the example of Muammar Gaddafi in Libya, who relinquished his weapons and then shortly was deposed and murdered and drugged through the streets. And I think if that's your example of what happens when you give away your weapons, it certainly explains why there's such a push to protect his regime and his power in North Korea.
Does everybody agree with that?
The rational basis for all of the Kim family actions is the retention of power and the continuation of the Kim family line in North Korea. Because it's better to be the king of a small, dysfunctional country than to be a pauper in somebody else's. So,
but what's important is you need to talk about who puts the king in, and maybe we can talk a little bit about the organization that's around him.
Well, that gets to the 40-40 Club, and I want you to explain to the audience what the 40-40 Club is, because you think that breaking into that club or disrupting that club may be the key to regime change there.
When you have a dictator or you have a unipolar government where all the power emanates and rests on one set of either narrower or rotund shoulders, it's the people around that leader that provide the support, that provide the mechanisms and run the agencies, bureaus, and elements that retain regime power. So in the Iraqi example, Saddam Hussein, when he fled and hid after the invasion, U.S. and allied forces were trying mightily to figure out where he was. And one of the things that they had to start looking at was, where are the photos from when Hussein was in power? Who are the old guys over the age of 40 whose waistline is over 40 inches? So the chubbier ones, the well-set ones that have been fed and cared for well, who are they and what did they do in the regime and where are they now and what are they doing? And there was a great deal of intelligence work on identifying those gentlemen, capturing them, using the information that was gained from their interrogations up the network.
That's the group that you see photographed surround Kim Jong-un.
They're
over 40, and they got a little weight on them.
Yeah, and in the North Koreans.
But how do you break into that? How do you get to them?
It's like law enforcement. It's like the way you get there's a show called Narcos, which is a really popular show. Yes. And if you watch that, you kind of get a sense for the mechanics on our side and how we go after it. You find one person, you get the leverage there. There's internal fighting. It's just subdued because it's such a authoritarian regime. But there's always conflict. There's always small group dynamics at play. You find one guy and say, hey, you know, France is awesome. You ever thought about going to France with your kids and everybody else and being set up for life? This is the little thing that we need from you. And then you just work that, and you work that.
And with the Kim family regime, their weakness is agents and representatives, specifically out of Bureau 39, which is their one of their state security apparatus that deals with international banking. They deal with international counterfeiting. They run businesses overseas, and they get hard currency back into the regime. And getting defectors out of that that segment of the international face of the North Korean population, that's where you can start rolling them up.
Are they like a crime family?
In my humble opinion, they are a crime family. There's nothing like about it. They're just criminals. They've stolen a country.
What else are they doing around the world that we may not know about? Is it and how effective and efficient are they with cyber-related activities?
I'm going to defer to somebody much smarter than me about cyber because I'm not. But they do human trafficking. They do methamphetamine and other drug production distribution. They do large-scale counterfeiting of not only U.S. but other international currencies. I know from on the cyber side, there was, I think it was the Bank of Bangladesh that they were trying to make a bum's rush for about $1 billion with a B dollars in assets. So they're an ongoing international crime
syndicate. So it is not just turning the screws to China and Russia and India. There are other players out there that do not have a direct link to a country, but they want money. Well, they want power.
Their biggest crime is extortion. I mean, what they export more than anything is fear, right? Give us this or we will blow up the world. Or like, it's 30 minutes for an ICBM to get to L.A. That's a pretty big threat. And they're using that as leverage. That's a crime.
So the thought process here then is to try to infiltrate this 40-40 club. But, again, how do you do that? There's no trust in the North Korean government. So how does somebody get in there?
Well, and it's the same way that was done with the difference being you have to understand their culture, their language, their belief system, where they've been raised, and then finding the good actors within our intelligence community and diplomatic community who can have relationships with these people once they're outside of North Korea. Because you can't get into North Korea and do it. The minders are there.
Right, but that could take years.
We should have been doing this for years.
Mark? Okay.
I was just going to take it back to a political point for a second that, you know, I don't know how the American public's feeling who voted for Trump. I did not, but I'm going to put myself in their position for a moment. And people elected Trump because he was going to shake up the system, and he said, I make deals. You know, so he's uniquely positioned to start a dialogue with North Korea, to make a deal, to sit down. But it's been one of the biggest disappointments. Even me, as I don't want our country to go to hell while Trump's in office. So I was hoping to see him make some deals. Okay, you're going to renegotiate some of these trade deals. Let's see what happens. Let's see if it benefits the American worker. And so here, as negotiator in chief, I want to see him go to North Korea.
So do I.
You know, instead
I want to see him take Dennis Rodman along.
Right.
A couple of weeks ago when we were on this program with learned experts. I mean, the learned experts from academia, they did not poo-poo that idea.
No, of course
Whereas
not.
A year ago, if I mentioned it, they thought it was crazy. But now, you're right. He's a great deal maker. Let's see if he can make this deal. 1-800-723-8289 from coast to coast and border to border. We got callers on the line. We'll continue our conversation. Also, in the second hour, we'll be talking about some things that are going on in Houston, some heroic stories that took place last week, and the devastation that still is being dealt with in that great American city. I'm Bruce Dumont. Don't go away. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us tonight from coast to coast and border to border on Labor Day. We're going to take some time out right now and talking about North Korea. We're going to come back to that discussion. People that are waiting on the line that want to talk about the subject, we will hear from you in a moment. But again, we do want to spend some time talking about what has been happening in Houston. The stories are devastating. The pictures for the last 10 days have been just riveting to watch. And there's been a lot of heroics there. Joining us now to share sort of his thoughts and opinions and his first-person account of what's things that he has seen with his own eyes is John Lopez. He is a sports talk show host on KILT. That is in Houston, the top sports talk station in Houston. And, John, nice to have you with us on Beyond the Beltway tonight.
Hey, my pleasure, man. Thanks for having me.
When you were covering the story last week, you moved from a person covering the story. You became part of the story. Exactly what did you see and what action did you take?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, it was so frustrating for me watching it all go down. Of course, I work in the toy department. I do a sports talk show. And, you know, you're supposed to be having a release from a lot of these things. And I'm an avid fisherman, like very avid. You know, I have a boat down in Sabine, which is on the Texas Gulf Coast and such. But my boat was 100 miles away from us here as the storm was happening and the waters were rising. And I was just frustrated that I couldn't go out there and, you know, use whatever expertise I have to try to help people. So it was devastating to watch. And I just kind of used social media. And I went out on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook and said, hey, you know, a lot of our listeners, you know that I'm an avid fisherman, that I'm a good boater. I said, hey, anybody have a couple extra boats or an extra boat? I'll be happy to captain it. I have all the life jackets and ponchos and the waters and everything else. And I didn't mean for it to become like a big story. I just wanted to get out there. I felt compelled. You know, it's like that old fisherman's code. You know, when you see a boat in distress, you got to stop everything and help them out. Mm-hmm. You know, Houston was in distress, so I tried to stop everything and help them out a little bit.
John, how widespread was your story of an indigenous person wanting to help? How often did that happen compared to maybe organized efforts by either the Red Cross, the Salvation Army, or local first responders?
Well, obviously, those guys were, you know, doing everything they could, and because we were so flooded, a lot of them couldn't get here until, you know, a couple of days after the fact. So there were, I would venture to say, maybe in the thousands, certainly in the hundreds of, you know, people like me who, you know, pretty avid and pretty, you know, have a little bit of expertise as voters, because it was pretty, you know, pretty high tides, pretty fast tides and rough waters, and so you had to kind of know what you're doing. But yeah, I'd say it was really awe-inspiring to watch these guys just dragging boats from Louisiana and other parts of Texas just to go help people. It was really, really awe-inspiring. That's kind of what I, you know, made me want to go out there and help too. And it was interesting when you're on the water, some of the things you see kind of humbling as well.
One thing that I think in the stories that that I've read and seen on television is that, and you just alluded to it, is sometimes when things are really, really bad, people do rise to the occasion and they do become engaged like you. And again, thousands of other people like yourself. And I'm going to take a moment to just go around the table here in Chicago to get everyone's sort of responses to what I'm about to say. Is sometimes in the darkest hour, this country and the people of this country show who they really are. Do you agree with that, Mark?
Oh, certainly.
And are we unique to, I mean, if the same thing happened in Australia or Austria, would the people be responding the same way, or are Americans unique?
Well,
I'm sorry, I didn't know if you were talking to me.
No, I'm gonna get back to you, but I want to hear the folks in Chicago talk, and then we'll get back to you.
The thing that impressed me so much was almost instantaneously, as soon as the water receded, that people were gutting the sheetrock from their house and were, you know, they're already treating and trying to rebuild their homes, like just instantaneously. And so that's incredible.
Martha, what about you? Because you lived in Houston and you know a lot of friends there.
I did. I lived in Houston for many years, and the pictures on the TV and stuff were just tearing me up. To answer your question, do I think the United States, the American people are unique? No. I do believe what you said, that darkest hours bring out the best in people. But if you look at what's happening in India right now with their monsoons, I mean, they're coming out and helping their neighbors. And Japan when the earthquake happened, China. I think it's instinctively inherent in people in the darkest of days to try to help their neighbor.
Roberto. A couple of things. So I really want to give a shout out to the private sector. People like Mattress Mac down in Houston. I don't know if you heard of that guy. He's got this gallery.
Oh, he opened up his store.
He's amazing,
yeah.
Right? And it's not just a one-time press, you know, hit. He did it before for Katrina. And so people are really, especially Texans. I was stationed in Texas. Texans are tough people. Texas is bigger than this storm, and it's going to be there tomorrow. And so people in Texas are helping each other out. The I don't want to get it wrong, but I think it's called the Cajun Navy. Like, I got a flatboat, I got some rope, how can I help? And Americans in general are, let's go get this done. I was in Japan during the tsunami earthquake. Those folks are also very, let's go get this, come together. And
so it's
this.
A human thing.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Colonel?
You know, you see what you look for. And in the aftermath of Charlotte, we had, and I'm talking about Charlottesville, West or Virginia, where we had the... white supremacist and squaring off with Black Lives Matter and Antifa. There was a lot of visible division of the white folks on this side, people of color on the other, and a lot of yelling in between. I think some of the most compelling images and footage I've seen coming out of Houston is a white mother and her child being carried out of the flood by a young black man, and likewise a young woman of color and her child being carried out by a white man.
No different.
People saving each other regardless. And that's the foundation of our country, and it's the strength of our country, and that's what we should be looking for instead of division.
John, back to you for the answer.
Well, I'll tell you this. When I'm a couple of the scenes that stood out to me is when I was boating through some water in Humble, Texas, which I guess a couple of your panelists will know that. The water was 5 or 6 feet deep, and I came across a truck with the engine running and the headlights on and the windshield wipers were still going. And the thought occurred to me all of a sudden, there may be a body in there, mm-hmm. You know? And it set me back and gave me pause. But when I got to the truck and kind of tied off there, I saw, you know, I looked around, I saw there was nobody there. Somebody was, the water was rising so fast that somebody got out of there as soon as they could. But I say that to say this. Every time I threw some people on the boat, figuratively speaking, I put some people on the boat. I never asked them who they voted for. I mean, mm-hmm. I didn't care. You know, you talk about color. Politics with all the venom and the vitriol and everything else going on in our country, especially politically speaking. I can just tell you this. Being in those waters and seeing the looks on the faces, and seeing, like you said, the Cajun Navy and some other guys that kind of took people out of the water. I think the lesson here is people are good. I mean, people are good. They're not always good, but when it counts, people are good.
Listen, thank you very much for your call. We do appreciate your report. And again, thanks for rising to the occasion and deciding to not just listen to the story and report the story, but throw yourself in and make things better. So, John Lopez, we thank you very much. A talk show host for KILT in Houston, Texas, joining us tonight. 1-800-723-8029. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about what's happening in North Korea. And also a little bit later on the broadcast, we'll talk a little bit more about Houston as well. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks for joining us tonight. Reaction to the federal government in this particular case in Houston has been, for the most part, positive. But again, it's going to cost an awful lot of money. The president has asked for, what, $9.5 billion. He wants Congress to react to that next week. It gets into whether or not the debt ceiling should go up and whether there's going to be money for the wall. I mean, it's all going to be wrapped up into what Congress has to do. But in times like this, Congress always comes up and they always provide the money. But Governor Abbott is talking about maybe the cost is going to be $150 to $200 billion because this area is so much larger than Katrina and some of the recent other hurricanes. So the battle over the politics and the money is going to start pretty quickly, Martha.
Yeah, I do think it's going to start pretty quickly. And unfortunately, that perfect storm that's hitting Washington with the debt ceiling and everything like that could muddy the waters. I hate
no
to use
intended.
That. No pun intended. Exactly. But I think the from a disaster relief perspective, and Governor Abbott saying $150 to $200 billion, that can't all be spent at once. But we've got to make sure that there's enough disaster relief appropriated to get those oil refineries and that industry, shipping industry, up and running, because that is the economic engine of that region, as well as a good portion of the United States.
Mark?
You know, I think about the individual homeowners who are affected, and, you know, they say that 80% of the homeowners didn't have flood insurance. They're going to find out very quickly that their policies probably had water damage sublimits that really, limit how much they can claim. So, you know, for me as a proud progressive, this is a clear example of where a strong, well, lean, organized federal government can come in and really help people. On Face the Nation today, the FEMA administrator was on, and they were basically pressing him to say, you know, are there going to be funds for those people who are left? And he really was kind of nervous, and he basically said, no, those people, they're not going to be made whole by what we can provide. It's going to be some assistance, and we're going to try to expedite it, especially for first responders. But for the average folk, you know, for me, I'm very concerned. I don't know how the tremendous impact that this has to have on these families.
By the way, we should mention that, and I tell the story about, you know, maybe once or twice a year, but I'm going to just tell it again because this is the right time to tell it. When we experience the devastation of what's happening in Houston, and now we're talking about a hurricane and we're talking about flooding, it could be, a twister. It could be, you know, other forms of major natural disaster. And we, you know, five or six times a year now we're dealing with things like this. And the story that I tell, and this is my own personal story, my own family. In 1938, I was not born yet, but my family was a fairly well-off family living in New London, Connecticut. And my father was in the boat business. And he was transferring boats during a period of time, and they were only going to be in New York, New London Harbor, New London, Connecticut, for a short period of time. And in that short period of time, and he did not have insurance, and he regrets that, he lost everything. And that hurricane, he never, ever recovered financially from that hurricane. The family went through very difficult fiscal times. So when you see what you see on television and the devastation of a family losing their house, that family is never, ever going to be the same again. It isn't just the physical loss of their belongings in that house that has now been flooded. But again, the devastation, the lifelong, life-altering effect of a hurricane on families that you see, and we're talking about tens of thousands of people living in Houston, Texas, and more so in the broader Houston area. So when you see those stories and you want to help and you send some money to the Salvation Army or the Red Cross to deal with the immediate needs of just, you know, saving them and getting them some clothing and trying to, you know, get through the next week in their lives and cleaning up their house. The devastation that goes on in their lives after the cameras have all gone away and all the FEMA workers have all gone off to the next disaster that takes place. Again, look at those people, because their lives will never be changed. They'll never be able to have the lives they have now. And many of them will live a life of just of spiraling, financial ruin. And it will be very difficult for them to put their lives. Now, some people do it, obviously. But again, I speak from a personal experience that the devastation of a hurricane is a lifelong, never-ending, devastating experience. At least it was for my family.
Well, they talk about, Bruce, too, is you know, some of the families that actually got hit by Katrina got relocated to Houston, and now they're the boom. But you know, Mark, I didn't want my comment about, you know, supporting the oil and this, you know, not making it about the people.
Sure.
But if you look at Beaumont right now, Beaumont has no fresh water. Their water plants are out. The federal government disaster relief needs to get down there and get Beaumont people with fresh water, get the, you know, and that is all about that engine in there. It's absolutely. You know, well, it's.
And folks living paycheck to paycheck,
yeah.
And whose jobs are have just, you know, literally dried up and disappeared.
I just wanted to add, you know, the government will not save us. We have to do this for each other. We have to come together with our nonprofits and our private enterprise. The average payout for Hurricane Katrina victim was $7,114.
And Sandy, I think, was only $5,000.
It was $8,000, $16.
Okay.
But it's trivial.
And you're, the company you work with is doing something.
What, I do. I don't want to mention online, but my company, I'm a realtor. We're sending 15,000 people down there next week. 15,000. We've already raised $20 million. Our CEO said, who's taking a personal commitment here? And everybody raised their hand. And we just said, we have to go. We are headquartered in Austin. Mm-hmm. I'll say that much. So we have a lot of love for Texas. I was stationed in Texas, and mm-hmm. everybody that I know is getting on those trucks. We already sent 3 18-wheelers full of water and diapers and canned goods. And so the private sector right now has the freedom to move fast. And now maybe isn't exactly the moment for scrutiny. I'm just going to trust the Red Cross today, because tomorrow I'll be there, or somebody else like us will be there.
Bobby Meehan, let's take you. You're with WUGB. That is our Beyond the Beltway television affiliate in Houston, and also a longtime viewer and listener to the program. Bobby, you've seen a lot unfold before, you know, within the blocks where you live and populate throughout the week. What are your observations of what you've seen this past week?
Well, Bruce, you know, amid the devastation that we've all experienced here, I think the big takeaway for me personally is not just the concept of neighbors helping neighbors, but it's total strangers helping total strangers. And, you know, nationally, I've read a lot of articles and seen a lot of pundits on TV talk about, you know, how this isn't necessarily the norm. But as you mentioned before, your panel mentioned before, that something like this really brings out the best in people. Now, the thing about it is that, you know, when we had folks come in, you know, we had guys come in from Louisiana and all over Texas and, you know, Arkansas and bring in their bass boats and their monster trucks. And, you know, you've got these basically, you know, rednecks out there rescuing people, just going into harm's way, taking people from their roofs, from the second stories of their homes, to get them to dry land. And, you know, that is here in Houston is the biggest vibe of gratitude and blessing that we're all feeling. Yes, I was very fortunate. I live 3 blocks from Buffalo Bayou near downtown. And believe me, I was checking on that around the clock, and as my neighbors were too, we weren't sure what was going to happen. And me being very fortunate, my neighbors around me being very fortunate, you know, we all jumped in to help with the relief effort somehow. I cleaned out closets to get blankets and towels and sheets and things that people would need in the shelters. George R. Brown Convention Center was the first shelter that was set up, and that filled within, you know, 2 or 3 days at about 9,100 people. Then,
Bobby, how is the average person on the street? How are they responding to the President of the United States there twice? What are the locals saying about the visit of the President?
From what I've heard from my friends and neighbors is that the reaction has been very positive. They like the fact that he came here and that, you know, he was out there greeting people today. He was out there in the middle of NRG Park at that shelter that is housing more people. And keep in mind, too, NRG Park, and before that was Reliant Park, you know, the Astrodome is there. And that was the ground zero for all the Katrina evacuees. So with the president being there, adding a little bit of levity and a little bit of support, everyone that I know that was down there that I talked with all through social media and on phones and afterwards when they came home said that the experience was really nice. And it was very uplifting for them because just in being there with the First Lady, added a little bit of more hope and aspiration and more support that we all needed, you know.
Bobby, listen, we've got to move on. As you know, we've got about commercial breaks. But Bobby Meehan is UGB. That's new Dumo for
KUGB.
What did I say? KUGB. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
Bobby, thanks very much for being with us and offering your first-person testimony as well as John Lopez about what's happening Houston, Texas. I'm Bruce Dumont. Back shortly from Chicago. The two of you. You can stick around, though, but Bruce Dumont back on the air, and we're just telling everybody what we're going to be doing in a few minutes. Let's go to Henry, listening to us in Killeen, Texas, on KLBJ. Go ahead.
Yeah, hey, Bruce, thanks for taking my call.
Thank you.
And I think, this isn't our first rodeo as far as the Texas Gulf goes.
Right.
And second point is, as far as one of your committee members is, that, the Exxon plant went down. It's coming back up. The Marathon plant, I think, went down, and that's coming back up. Don't know when. But, we expect these kind of things. And I'm from Central Texas. I wasn't at all had a problem with Harvey. But, the bottom line is that I think it's all on a political plane right now that we look at is North Korea on the strategic level or the national level, and Harvey on the domestic level.
Right.
And what we're doing is just going on to another continuing resolution after another as it goes on. And somebody's got to put the foot down and say, no.
But, Henry, here's one thing. No one, I don't think there's, whether they're a Republican or a Democrat, it's very difficult for any politician to say no to disaster relief when such a large portion of a particular state or city is being devastated. Because there are other people in other parts of the country who've gone through hurricanes or tornadoes, so that even the most conservative of conservative Republicans, I think, would say, you know what, we've got to find some way to help these people because their lives have been ruined. They're devastated, and these are American dollars being spent to help Americans rebuild their lives by rebuilding property. It's creating jobs. It's creating all kinds of things. I don't think it's one of these things where you're going to have anybody say we're not going to do it. You're holding up. You think Ted Cruz is? What was your point about Ted Cruz?
He's got a record of saying screw that guy. I mean, forget me for being partisan for a second, but I just feel like Ted Cruz dropped that moral authority when in the previous chapter of this American story, and now he's seen the light. We're all Texans now, but we were all whatever it was before.
But there was money for Katrina. The federal government didn't say no to Katrina relief.
It's my understanding that people are mad at Ted Cruz because he was not in favor of that support.
Well, Ted Cruz wasn't in favor of the support for Sandy, the Superstorm Sandy in the Northeast. But he was opposed not to the disaster relief going to the Northeast. He was opposed to the pork that was put into the bill for items that had absolutely nothing to do with the support of the disaster relief. And my only hope is that the current government, both Democrats and Republicans, when they start doing appropriations for this disaster relief, it is solely for the purpose of this disaster relief, and it's monitored as such. Keep the general budget out of it. Keep the debt ceiling. They need to separate the two, and that's what Cruz was opposed against. He wasn't opposed to disaster.
But he changed his mind on this one.
No, he still doesn't want pork put in the project.
He doesn't want pork, but again, you're right.
Am I still on or what?
No, go ahead. You're on, Henry. Go ahead.
Okay, my point is that, we're talking about, a CRC as opposed to a elimination of sequestration or, you know, putting money into Afghanistan, where we're going to up the ante there, and, you know, into North Korea from the standpoint that, you know, how are we going to deal with them?
Well, I don't think people are – there isn't a debate at the moment about the financial implications of North Korea. I mean, no one has said we need, you know, billions of dollars more to do certain things. At least I've not heard that as part of the debate. My point is this, is that when Americans are looking at television and they're seeing other Americans seeing their lives destroyed, and they may be from a part of the country that has their own natural disasters, whether it's fires or floods or tornadoes, I don't think Americans get too riled up if federal money is being used to help Americans who have been subject of these devastating weather occurrences.
And earlier, Bruce, you had...
It's not like sending money to Afghanistan. Right. I totally agree with that. Or building another bomber. I totally agree with that.
And earlier, Bruce, you asked the questions, are Americans unique in helping each other? And one of the areas that I think that America is unique is in our pocketbooks. I mean, we do open up our pocketbooks, like your company, Roberto. I mean, my company that I retired from is there. At Hollywood, you can talk about the Hollywood people coming out. They're going to put on a big telethon, yeah, and people will open up their pocketbooks. America is a generous country from our pocketbooks, which some countries do not have that wherewithal to open up the pocketbooks.
Right.
And earlier, Bruce, you put forward the question, you know, the response in Austria or Australia to a flood or a natural disaster. I can't talk about Australia. Want to visit there sometime. But I have been in Europe, and I've been there for floods. And the European model is, okay, we will do what we're told to do, and then it's the government's job to take care of us. And we defer as a people to the government and the expert. And especially in Germany, there was a lot of floods that we had in the winter of 93-94 that I was a spokesman for. The difference in America that I see as one of our underlying strengths is whether it's John Lopez and getting a borrowed bass boat and just going and making a difference, or the Yahoos of the Cajun Navy driving down from Arkansas or God Louisiana or wherever, or the monster trucks. Men and women who want to do good, who have the capacity to do good, and aren't waiting for permission, they're just stepping forward and doing it.
Go
ahead, sir.
Yes, sir. And I think that's all indicative of the refugee problem in Europe. And Prime Minister Merkel, in you know, putting the borders down and accepting so many refugees in, is that, you know, there is a continuum of resolution among the people in the country that gets to a point.
Well, in Germany, they're going to have an election here real soon,
yeah,
and there is a populist candidate that's making inroads and growing in market share. Unfortunately, Germany has a bad history with populist, you know, politicians,
right, yeah,
coming to power.
Yeah.
So,
Henry, we're going to move on. Thanks very much for your call. Let's go back to Josh. He's in Nashville, Tennessee, listening to us on WNOX. And you want to pick up the conversation we had in the last hour about North Korea, correct, Josh?
Yeah, that's right, Bruce. Thanks for taking my call. And I want to preface, and this will be a question for the panel, I want to preface this by saying that we don't need the South Koreans and we don't need the Japanese. They need us for protection. Now, with that being said, and I'm sure everybody would agree with that statement,
mm-hmm,
that being said, do we wait until, God forbid, a mushroom cloud envelops San Francisco or Honolulu, and then when that happens, the president, after our response, gets on TV and says, well, we didn't act preemptively with conventional weapons before anybody jumps the gun, with conventional weapons to take out his delivery systems and his weapons making facilities because of the artillery strikes and the rocket strikes against the South Koreans and the Japanese. At what point, my question for the panel is, at what point is American lives worth more than our allies' lives.
Roberto.
The decapitation strike approach has been heavily considered and been set back from by Mathis. I think we all trust Mad Dog. We have 50,000 troops in Japan, 25,000 troops in South Korea, 6,000 troops in Guam. Those are a lot of troops in harm's way right now. And, you know, I want to point out my colleague here, Ryan, he said, you know, it doesn't have to be on the missile. Could be on the freighter. Could be on a small boat. There's the stakes are so high that it just kind of makes sense in game theory to do the diplomatic thing. And so I'm not on the I'm not privy to what's inside the Pentagon these days, but I would imagine that they've considered that and they have chosen not to go with that option.
All right. Any follow-up to you, Josh?
And I understand it's a difficult question that they have to weigh. But at some point, American lives, especially innocent civilian lives on the West Coast and however far inland those missiles could reach, you know, and
okay.
As brutal as it sounds, is a few thousand dead of our allies, is that more important than 400,000 dead Americans?
I think it's more than 400. So. I think it's more than a few hundred thousand. But Ryan, you or Colonel, you had a... The numbers are much greater, our allies,
not
a couple of thousand people.
As far as here's the problem with going to a kinetic solution or going into a preemptive strike into North Korea. To be successful, you have to have what I'll call 110% accuracy and success. You've got to get over the goal line to the point where the North Koreans cannot respond. And the North Koreans, unfortunately, are going to have the capacity. So it's mutually assured destruction. We have to contain. And that's the way going forward.
13 million people in Tokyo.
We got to move on. Josh, thanks for your call. 1-800-723-8029. I'm Bruce Dumont. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago, and one of the issues we have not talked about, but it's going to be front and center next week, and we've touched around it a number of times over the last couple of years on this program, and that is the issue of the Dreamers. What is President Trump going to do next week, in your view, Roberto? Is he going to continue the policy of the Obama administration, or as he's promised in his campaign, is he going to end the dream for the Dreamers?
Our thought leader, for lack of a better word, is Durbin. And I'll just quote him real quick. DACA, for people that don't know what the Dreamers are, it protects 800 young immigrants who are American in every way. And they were brought
800,000
were brought over as babies and carried across the border. But they grew up here. They love this country. I would remind everybody that we have non-U.S. citizens serving in our military. Last time I checked, over 40,000, right? So, you can contribute to this country, pay taxes, buy homes, go to school. And remember, 70% of our economy is consumption. If you take away the DACA kids who are working now, it hurts our so many industries. So it's not in the president's interest to do that. However, I think what the president's doing is it's red meat for the base. And I think he's going to stand down at the end of the day. I don't think the president's going to go forward with that.
Martha Music, you're our card carrying Republican.
Yeah,
you like the president, not everything he does. What do you think he's going to do on DACA, and what should he do on DACA?
Well, I don't think he is. I think he's going to throw it back to Congress to try to fix it. The thing about what I really am discouraged about with DACA is, while Obama administration brought it in through executive order, so I don't necessarily fully understand the constitutionality that a lot of the attorney generals are trying to pull. But what I don't like about it is, when one administration says to people, if you meet these qualifications, you're going to college, you're employed, or you join the military or are in the military, come out of those shadows, register with the United States, and you're fine. And now all of a sudden the next administration coming in and saying we're going to pull that rug out from underneath you, it just is, to coin a phrase, it's mean. That's why I don't think DACA is going to be completely repealed. I think we probably should have gone one step further with DACA and say, okay, you're in college, you're working, you're in the military, and you've got X amount of years to become a United States citizen.
Should this be codified, and do you think the president is going to come down hard against the Dreamers, or is he going to, as Martha suggested, either send it to Congress or let him off the hook?
Yeah, I don't see him punting it back to Congress because they're so dysfunctional, and he's going to want to move on with some other pieces of agenda. Given the Arpaio pardon, the attacks on sanctuary cities, the wall, I think he's going to go after DACA. And I wish he wouldn't, because there's so many people just contributing to our country that want to be Americans and came here by no fault of their own, and they're Americans. They're Americans now.
Here's I'm gonna go the other way on that question, or challenge you on that particular point, because he's done all the things that the base likes with Arpaio and others and sanctuary cities, because he's fighting that fight, and also acting by pardoning Arpaio. Maybe to the Dreamers, and he has said on camera in the past that, he hinted that maybe he's going to let them off the hook. Mm-hmm. I think he's going to let them off the hook.
I agree.
I think he's going to say, and he may say this, I'm going to let them off the hook, meaning the 800,000 because of the case that Roberto made. I'm going to let them off the hook. But I'm not going to let my promise to build a wall off the hook. And if he does throw it back to Congress, maybe he wants Congress to have some example of providing funding for the wall. You provide funding for the wall, Congress, and I will waive DACA by presidential order. That's the trade-off.
If he made a permanent policy push, which Ryan would agree with, because Ryan's telling him not to do the DACA thing, then most Democrats would say, we'll take it. We'll take that deal. However, because the wall's irrelevant. Nobody cares about the wall as a structural thing. It's just a political ploy for the base.
My point is, his base cares about it. So his base, which would probably be they some in the base, not all in the base.
Sure, but
I think people in the base would be upset if he didn't build the wall. I'm not so sure that people in the base would be equally upset if it was focused on these 800,000 DACA people. I think he could get away with a compassionate decision on DACA if he continues to play a hard line. And what I'm just saying is he basically puts it down for moderate Republicans and Democrats to say, okay, I'm going to give you what you want on DACA. But you know what? You're going to give me some money for that wall.
Yeah, so $480 billion of that will come from leaving the DACA kids, because that's how much money they produce in revenue. They produce $480 billion of revenue.
Well, I'm going to encourage him, unsolicited advice for POTUS from Ryan Yanis is, okay, one of the strengths of our government is a rule of law, not the rule of man.
Sure.
Part of the problem of having executive orders signed by a president that has a shelf life and it lasts as long as that administration is that's rule of man.
Yes.
So we have made a false promise as a nation through this rule of man executive order. Let's establish the law. Go back to Congress. Hold their feet. Make them do their job, because we have three distinct branches of government. What we have with a very interesting gentleman in the White House, we also have a dysfunctional Congress that needs to start performing and being held accountable.
But Ryan opened the door to allow it to be thrown back.
And that's Speaker Ryan.
That's Speaker Ryan. Yes, I'm sorry. Yes. Speaker Ryan.
We are out of time, folks, for our broadcast this evening. Thank you all for being with us. I want to thank also Dan Dorfman, Sam Greenberg for their assistance in the production of this program. Have a wonderful Labor Day tomorrow. Don't have too much barbecue. Hope the weather is good wherever you are. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thank you, and good night from Chicago.